Hello, my friends. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. And I'm really glad you're listening today because we're doing something completely unique. I've never done this before. We're actually doing two shows in a row in which we will be critiquing a critique. And when I say we, I mean John Noyes and I were teaming up on this, and he's helping me out on it. John, glad to have you on board for the show.
Good to be here.
And the critique that we are critiquing is actually that was one that was made by an atheist of a STRU that we did on atheism called Atheism Bumping into Reality. That's the title of that. That came out earlier this year, didn't it, John, along with yours on evil, I think January, right?
That's
when
right, yeah.
We released that. And so you may not have seen this. By the way, Drew is his handle online. He's a very popular YouTuber, and his handle is the genetically modified skeptic, right? And you saw the critique, right, that he offered, right, John?
Yeah, absolutely. The whole thing, yeah.
Yeah. And so we watched it together now that I think about it. And so there are many, many things that Drew said that were expressed his concern about the kinds of points that I made in the STRU regarding atheism versus theism, and there were something I wanted to notice about Drew. By the way, he seems like a really nice guy. All right, for the most part, he seems very smooth. He's very confident in his presentation. He's very measured, and he's very persuasive sounding. And this, by the way, is an interesting observation that you might keep in mind, that when somebody is smooth and confident and measured, they're persuasive. Their persuasiveness goes with the style. And sometimes it can mask poor arguments. Now, what this means, of course, in application is if you have good style and good arguments, you're even more persuasive. That's cool. But if someone's style that you're listening to is really good, that means you have to look more carefully at the substance and see if the substance matches the style. So what Drew is doing here is what might be called peer review. Is someone else. John, you're familiar with this concept, you know, when people kind of step in. And we do this all the time on our own team, right?
And it's fun, right? Every month, at least. Yes.
John is one of the few people that I know that actually likes being peer-reviewed, you know.
I
He's
do.
Got a big smile on his face and whatever. But
it's how you get better.
It is. And exactly. And this is something I hope takes place here in our critique over the next two shows. And so the key to responding to a critique or a peer review of one's view is to carefully isolate the points that they make and isolate them to make them clear. And I talked about this, I think, last week, the concept of peer review and how sometimes you have to deal with the, you know, the rhetoric or the hand waving and stuff like that, you know, John. So this kind of comes in. Let's just isolate what exactly is being said here. And then you need to think them through to see if there's any substance to the criticism. And this is really something good for us. Because one of three things I think is going to happen, John, and that is that the critique that we're going to find that the critique was unsound.
Yeah.
And that may give us more confidence in our view than we had before because we've faced up to the challenges. We may find out that our own case was not as clear as it might have been. All right. And then we got to fix that. And
which actually, is something we want to know.
Yeah,
and we
right.
want to know if it's not sound.
And I think that was the case here in Drew's critique. I'll get to that a little bit later. We may discover that the critique was actually good in some points, that some aspects of our views were not that good, maybe false, and we can abandon those things for better views. So it's all good, as the saying goes here. So what was being critiqued? as I mentioned, was this SDRU class called Bumping into Reality. Drew's approach is to, one, correct me where he felt that I had misconstrued facts, especially pertaining to atheism, and some other details, and that's what I call the just the facts, ma'am, tactic. He also sought to rebut certain points I was making. He does this largely by giving alternate possible explanations meant to undercut the force of my point. So he said, basically, Kokel's point is not necessarily so because there's a different way to understand how this issue can be resolved. And that's also a standard and legitimate approach to doing peer review. There was one case where Drew actually used a parallel illustration that was meant to show that my view led to an absurd conclusion. This is called a reductio, or in standard reason, we call it taking the roof off. So these are all legitimate approaches to making an assessment. And so my goal here, John, is simply to answer as the best I can the substance of the challenges that Drew raised as I was comparing the explanatory power of Christian theism to atheism, all right? And that's really what this course was about, and I'll give some more detail about that in a moment. And so just for those of you listening, this, John's main role is to be Drew here because I have a complete transcript of the critique online that Drew did. And so we're isolating points that Drew made, and then John's going to be reading those, and I'll be responding to them. So that's basically how this is going to work out. And on a personal note, let me say this, though, that I am really thrilled to do this. I'm happy to have an opportunity to cover ground that I couldn't cover in the SDRU class. I mean, this five sessions that are 7 to 12 minutes long. I mean, okay, that's not much. That's bare bones stuff. Actually, a criticism we'll get to was raised about that, but you can only do so much, right? And just because you are doing a bare bones approach doesn't mean that the things you say aren't valid, though. It just means that you're not giving a whole bunch of backstory that might help people to see how valid the point may be. And then it leaves you open for other criticisms that Drew has raised here. So I'm glad to be able to respond to that, to answer Drew's questions, to clarify some confusion, to rectify places where I wasn't as clear as I might have been, and hopefully increase the persuasiveness of the case that I was making for theism in this case. Now, a couple of things, John, I'd like our people to watch for here. Mm-hmm. And that there are a number of references that Drew makes that where he says, I'm trying to prove Christianity. Strictly speaking, that's not my goal here. I'm not trying to do that. I'm just trying to demonstrate that a theistic worldview has more explanatory power about important things that we actually experience in the world, that we bump into, ergo the title, than the atheistic worldview. And I'm construing, and we'll see, I'm construing this concept of theism and atheism in a very classical fashion, okay? So there is a concern that surfaced many times in the discussion Drew raised, and you'll notice this, that that Drew felt his explanations were better because they had empirical support to them, or at least he appealed to empirically verifiable alternatives, and mine did not, okay? I appeal oftentimes to intuitions, all right? That's a deep knowledge that we have that we don't know how we got it, certainly not empirically. This is a common thing for philosophers to do. I appeal to moral intuitions. I appeal to rational intuitions. I appeal to metaphysical notions that are intuitively. By the way, so does Drew, okay? He makes moral statements, and he also makes rational statements that trade on intuitions regarding those things. But when I do it, he has a dismissive approach to that. You know, like I'm not, that's not really an argument because it's not empirical. So I'm just noting that that's going to come up. And so I'll try to point that out when it does come up. But let me just offer a little mini lesson, if I can here, John, on epistemology. Okay, this is how we know what we know. Okay, it turns out that empiricism, that is using the five senses to discover our world, is a great way to learn things. It's one way to know stuff, but it isn't the only way. Sometimes we know things by logical inference, and that's not empirical, all right? Sometimes we're using an inference to the best explanation. That's called abductive reasoning. That's not an empirical enterprise. Sometimes we're using the concept of parsimony to decide between two competing concepts, and that's classically called Occam's razor. Sometimes we are doing direct introspection, okay? And sometimes we're dealing with metaphysical concepts like causation. So empiricism is legitimate, but it's one of many. And if there is an excessive appeal to empirical methods, what this is a signal to, John, is that the person who does this is probably relying on science too much.
Yeah.
Okay. Now you've heard about the notion of scientism, the idea that since empirical methods are the best methods to know things, that science, which uses empirical methods in its discovery, is the best way, or probably more aggressively put, the only way to know things with certainty. That's called scientism. And there does seem to be a little of that that's coming through in Drew's approach to the questions that I address in the discussion. Okay. And just a note, by the way, a scientism, that science is the way we really know things and everything else is just conjecture and opinion. Philosophers reject this largely because it's obviously self-refuting, because the statement that science is the way we know things most reliably itself is not known by science or by empirical methods. It's a philosophical statement about science. Okay. So that's a problem with that. But anyway, you'll just notice that trend. All right. And I'll speak to that when it comes up. So let's see, what else do I want to say here? I guess the last thing I want to say is that maybe one thing you notice is that in a lot of these points, John, I think that Drew was kind of talking past me or past my point. Did you get that sense?
Yeah, when I got that same sense. Yeah.
Yeah, like he's not really getting the point I'm making. He's responding to something else. All right. And not to the particular thing. Anyway, people have to decide on that when they hear Drew's critique. But let's just start with Drew's opening salvo. So go ahead. Your turn now, John.
Yes. Well, this is how he opens his portion of the critique. He says that it's not, in fact, an actual university. He's been doing this. He's referring to you. He says he's Kokel's been doing this for a while, so I expected the course to be a bit more on the nuanced side of apologetics. Was I right? Well, you'll just have to judge for yourself. The course consists of 5 video lectures, each running between 7.5 and 12 minutes. And that's how he starts his critique.
Okay, good. Well, I plead guilty on this one. This isn't a real university, but I kind of give credit to my audience that they realize that. Immediately. I mean, these are, as Drew describes, there are 5 videos that are 7 to 12 minutes each. As I mentioned before, this is a bare bones kind of analysis. And it's not nuanced, because that's not what you do in these kinds of videos. There's a whole lot more that can be said about every one of these points to give them more depth. But by the way, just because it's not nuanced, it doesn't mean that the points aren't sound and that the bare evidence I give in favor of the points is not good evidence. It may not be adequate for some people. Okay, I can get that. But it doesn't mean that it's somehow compromised by that. But I don't think anybody thought they were going to get anything different or think they're going to get anything different when they come to the STRU presentations, ones that you do, I do, Ellen does, Tim does, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So I actually plead guilty, but I don't think this is a substantive objection, so I'll just leave it at that.
And, now, Greg, can I just add something? It's also like he started off by saying that it's not a real university, and I don't think anybody expects us to be, purporting to be a real university.
Right. Yeah. And if it was a real university, they're not going to get a 1 hour course on atheism, you know, and there's going to be homework and there's going to be tests, you know, and all that other stuff. So we're making this in reach of other folks. So here's the way I launch, because this is a presentation, a class on atheism versus theism. And I make this point right at the beginning, John, that I'm asking the question, which worldview has the most explanatory power, that it has the ability to explain three particular things that we bump into, is the way I put it, in the real world. One of them is what I call the bump of stuff, and here I give a cosmological argument. The second is what I call the bump of bad, and here I bring in the moral argument. And then the third one is the bump of me, and this is where I introduce the existential element that is important to this issue, okay? So I launched the piece by saying, of all the questions that every human being asks about what's true or about what's important or about what's meaningful, there is no more significant question to answer than this one. Does God exist? God's existence is the most decisive issue of life, because the answer you give to that one question sets an irrevocable course for everything that follows. So out of the gates, here is Drew's first challenge.
Yeah, and to that, he says this, and this is a quote from Drew himself. He says, "This is true from a particular Christian view, but remove the assumption of that worldview, and this is not necessarily the case. Let's assume a God does exist. Does that tell us about its nature, its influence on the cosmos? If and how it relates to morality, if it's alone or just one of many? No. The fact of God's existence doesn't tell us anything about whether its existence is in any way relevant to human life."
Okay.
That's what he says.
Okay, good. I think, in a certain sense, this is something listeners are going to have to answer for themselves. But classically, this has been the big question for multitudes for millennium, okay, and for good reason. And the reason is that ideas have consequences. I mean, of course, there's more detail we could go into regarding God, but as we'll see in a moment, there is a fairly clear sense that most people have, especially in Western civilization, which I'm addressing, regarding God. Okay, and what that term actually means, okay? And what I'm talking about here now is an objective state of affairs, not a subjective. I'm not asking whether people care about it or not. I'm asking whether it, in fact, bears on vital issues in our life. Okay, think about this. Tolstoy writes famously in Brothers Karamazov, "If there is no God, then everything is permitted." Richard Dawkins, an atheist, also was a theist. Richard Dawkins says, "The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference." Now, I just have to ask you, even from Dawkins' perspective, does somebody want to say that the kind of world that he just described there, that is bereft of God, that there's no really big ramifications for that? Okay. George Gaylord Simpson, he's one of the most influential paleontologists of the 20th century. He says, "Mankind is the result of a purposeless and natural process that did not have him in mind." Maybe, but is that without consequence?
Yeah.
Doug Fatuma, yeah. He's the author of Science on Trial, The Case for Evolution. I think this is probably the number one book on evolution. It has been in the past. A textbook. Now, here's what he says. Some shrink from the conclusion that the human species was not designed, has no purpose, and is the product of mere mechanical mechanisms. But this seems to be the message of evolution. And evolution is something that Drew engages, and atheists do, as a naturalistic explanation for the development of life on Earth. But here's my question. That's from Douglas Fatuma. Why would people shrink from that conclusion? And I tell you, the reason they shrink from it, and he acknowledges it, the atheist himself, because it has profound ramifications for life. Okay. So I can, in a certain sense, sympathize with Drew's comment, in that I can see why someone would just shrug off as inconsequential to them personally this issue of God. I mean, if they don't believe in God and they're fine with their life as it is, then the God question is not going to be a big deal to them. Okay, I got it. I guess our listeners here, John, are going to have to decide for themselves whether my point, my opening salvo, was reasonable or not. And this question about God's existence has any significant ramifications for life. I'm chuckling because it just seems like obviously it does. And I will say classically, it's been a big deal.
Yeah.
Okay, now we come into a place where there's was actually a lot of conflict or a lot of consternation expressed by Drew, and this is the matter of definitions. So I'm starting out my class, I got to define my terms, and here's what I say. First, we need to define our terms here. Now, we know what theism is. It's a belief that there is a personal God, a conviction that God exists. Atheism, I said, is just the opposite. Atheism is the belief that there is no God. And then Drew's objection.
And Drew, to that, he responds, this is a very, very self-serving definition of atheism.
Of theism.
Theism, sorry. Theism can mean the belief in the existence of a personal God. But it can also mean the belief in the existence of an impersonal God, or many gods, or a divinity which permeates the universe. I'm not a prescriptivist, is what he says. And then he goes on to say that I don't think words have intrinsic definitions. I'm a descriptivist, one who defines words according to my observations of common usage. Kokel can define his theism as a belief in a personal God. That's fine. But to say that the definitions of theism, which have existed for millennia, this definition forces the viewer to think of theism through an exclusively Christian lens without any justification for doing so. At best, this is lazy teaching. And then he says, at worst, it's deceptive. And how would you respond to that?
Okay.
There's a lot there.
Yeah, there is a lot there. And I'm going to say a lot about this because there's a lot of verbal ink spilled on this issue in Drew's critique. We're not giving everything that he says. We're giving the substance of it in actual quotes from Drew. And if people want to get the whole thing, they can go see his entire 45-minute video critique, and that's just fine with me. Okay.
But, Greg, we should make it clear that like we're not also sampling his quotes. These are block quotes. There's no ellipses in them.
That's right.
So this is what he says for 100 words straight.
That's right. Okay. There might be one or two exceptions to that, but we're leaving out stuff that doesn't bear on the meaning of it. Okay. So that's a good point, John. Thank you. And the first thing I want to say is I agree with Drew about meanings of words, that they're conventional. And that's why we have dictionaries, to see how people normally use words in conversation. So just for the record, I did not go to the Bible for my definitions. I went to the dictionary. So I'm using the words exactly as Drew describes, according to their common usage. For example, Cambridge English Dictionary, theism is the belief in one God as the creator and ruler of the universe. Britannica says, theism, the view that all limited, or finite things are dependent in some way on one supreme or ultimate reality of which one may also speak of in personal terms. In Judaism, Christianity and Islam, this ultimate reality is often called God. Okay? Standard definitions. What about atheism? Dictionary.com. Atheism is the belief that there is no supreme being or deity. American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language. Atheism is disbelief in or denial of the existence of God or gods. Now, I just want to make an observation about that one word, disbelief, or phrase, disbelief in. Okay? It doesn't say lack of belief in. It says disbelief in. That is a belief that God does not exist, which is just another way of saying denial of the existence of God or gods. That's my definition of atheism. Now, are there exceptions to those definitions? Of course there are exceptions, but I'm not dealing with those exceptions. Right. I'm dealing with these particular senses of theism, atheism. And by the way, it's only practical. If you are going to enter into a general discussion about a topic, as opposed to talking to an individual person, which I'll get to that in just a moment, well, it's usually best to use the conventional definition of the terms in question. And if you choose a unique definition, if an atheist, for example, wants to do it, that's up to them. But then they're talking about a different topic. And this is an important point that I need to make regarding these definitions, John. I am not critiquing Drew's personal beliefs. And oftentimes he seems to act as if I am. He uses the term interlocutor a few times, like when you're talking with an atheist. This isn't about talking with an atheist. This is a class comparing two worldviews, theism and atheism, classically construed. And I'm simply asking which worldview has more explanatory power given the nature of reality. This is not a chat with an atheist who has a novel definition of atheism, which definition we'll get to in a moment. And by the way, if the definitions that I've offered are not Drew's personal definitions of atheism, if it doesn't describe his atheism, then my critique does not apply to Drew. It's as simple as that. And there's more to say because there's more objections on this point, but I do want to make a quick observation about Drew's comments about the variety of definitions for theism. Drew got his categories confused. Belief in the existence of an impersonal God is not theism. It's monism. Belief in many gods, that's not theism. That's polytheism. Belief in a divinity which permeates the universe, that's not theism either. It's pantheism. So I'm just clarifying precision on these particular issues is important, and this is what I'm trying to do. But Drew has more to say about this because in the presentation, I did warn viewers of what I think is a dodge, which is a use of definitions of atheism that atheists have recently begun to use to avoid any of burden of proof for their view. And so what I said is some atheists are going to say, well, they don't they're not asserting that there is no God. They are merely saying they lack a belief in God. And in fact, when I looked up the definitions in some of the dictionaries, they included this definition because it's being used more and more today. Now, frankly, if I were an atheist, I would not describe myself that way because I wouldn't think it's entirely accurate. And those atheists that are out there writing and doing YouTube presentations, et cetera, are not talking about their lack of beliefs. Yeah. I lack a belief, John, about who the best rugby team in Australia is, although right. That might be the Blacks, or maybe that's New Zealand. I don't know. But because I'm not, you don't know either. So we lack those beliefs because we're not invested at all in that. We have no beliefs about that. But it is not the case that atheists have no beliefs about God. They lack a belief in God, but they still have a belief about God, and the belief about God that they have is that God does not exist, therefore fulfilling the standard definition of atheism. But in any event, Drew presses his point that my definitions are manipulative, but then he also makes a telling admission. So go ahead and read what he says, John.
Yeah, those are really good points. And to that, actually, he says, many on both sides somehow think that defining atheism in a particular way is a victory for their tribe, as if defining the word a particular way proves either the rationality or irrationality of self-described atheists. It doesn't. And then he goes on to say this. He says, you cannot define another person's position into existence just by defining the label they use differently.
Which is what he's accusing me of doing. Right. Okay.
That's right. So that's the accusation. And then he goes on to say, I'd call myself, he's describing himself here. He says, I'd call myself an atheist, but rather an agnostic. In my day-to-day life, though, calling myself agnostic often gives others an inaccurate perception of my position. Where I come from, people often take agnostic to mean that someone is sitting on the fence about whether the Christian God is real or not. I'm not sitting on that ultra-specific fence, though, and describing myself as an atheist usually communicates that adequately.
Let me just pause for a minute, John,
before
you get to the rest of his quote. I just want people to see this. He says, I am not sitting on that ultra specific fence, though, okay, that fence of agnosticism about whether or not the Christian God is real. He's not on that fence. He's off the fence, which is just another way of saying he does not think the Christian God is real. Okay,
that's right.
Continue.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And then he goes on a little later. He says, your fixation on this definition, which is almost definitely related to a notion of the superiority of your tribe, is incompatible with constructive dialogue on God belief. Focusing more on establishing your favorite definition of atheism than on what your self-described atheist interlocutor, that's that word that you mentioned earlier, actually believes, will only reveal to them that you care more about scoring points against them than actually having a real conversation.
Okay, I'm just going to ignore the kind of character challenge there because it's not relevant, all right? Drew misses a critical issue here. And this, I think, another case where he's talking past my point. Drew might have a point here about definitions that an atheist is really someone who lacks a belief in God. If I were talking to Drew, I'm not talking to Drew, though. I'm giving a class about competing worldviews. And so here I'm going to appeal to Drew to follow his own good advice. I am defining my terms for my class. These are the issues that I am dealing with. And since this is my critique, I get to critique the ideas as I define them, not as Drew defines them. And I have defined these terms in a standard, conventional way, which is why I made appeal to dictionaries. But this does raise a question, okay? Drew can define his atheism as lacking a belief in God. I have no problem with that at all. But, and this is the telling admission, Drew also believes that there is no God. So he also qualifies as an atheist under the standard definition that I'm using. Okay? Drew is not an agnostic sitting on the fence about God. He's made that clear. Drew believes there's no God. So regardless of how Drew describes his atheism, what really matters is if his own belief fits the standard definition, and it does. Drew may lack a belief in God, so he is an atheist in that sense, but he also clearly thinks that God does not exist, so he is an atheist according to the standard definition. There's no sleight of hand here.
Yeah.
So there should be no complaint. This is not a self-serving definition. It is the standard one that applies even to Drew, his lack of belief notwithstanding. Okay? So that's introductory material. Let's go into the bumps. Three bumps, bump of stuff, bump of bad, and bump of me. Here's the bump of stuff. And what I'm going to introduce here is the cosmological argument, John, and you're very familiar with this. A cosmological argument is an argument for God based on the existence of the cosmos, okay? There are actually a couple of versions of this. One is based on the cosmos coming into existence. It's the one I trade on, also known as the Kalam cosmological argument. There's another one by Gottfried Leibniz that trades on the principle of sufficient cause and or sufficient reason, and this doesn't require the universe to come into existence, but it still argues for God's necessity because the cosmos is here. So when I start out, basically, I said, why is there stuff? Why is there something here rather than nothing here? The classic question that Leibniz addresses. Where did everything come from? Or put more specifically, what caused the beginning of the universe? Okay. And now here I go into an anecdote. Actually, it's not an anecdote. Yeah, it's an anecdote, not an illustration. It was a genuine conversation I had with somebody in a presentation where he asked me to prove God's existence or give reasons for God. And I asked a series of questions of him, setting it up. I said, do you think things exist? Yes. Do you think that things exist, always existed? No. In other words, they came into existence at a certain point in time. Yeah, great. Big Bang, whatever you want to call it. There was an absolute beginning. Most people believe this, and I pointed out that most philosophers and atheists reject an eternal universe. Okay, right. So let me just read exactly what I said here in the video as I'm making this point, because I'm going to ask the question, okay, what caused everything to come into existence? Either something or nothing. Either something or nothing. Now, I repeated that because I wanted people to realize that I'm working with a rational category here. It's either something or it's not something, which is also called nothing. Okay? Either A or non-A. That's the law of excluded middle. It can't be both. That violates the law of non-contradiction. It can't be neither. The law of excluded middle. I'm working very, very precise logical categories here. So here's what I actually said, John. This is a question about whether the universe came into being or not. And there's hardly anybody in the world, I say in the video, any scientist or philosopher actually, who thinks the universe is eternal anymore. Important words there. Eternal anymore, for good reason. Because the scientific evidence for the beginning of the universe is really strong. Okay, Big Bang, if you will. Okay. And now in response, Drew is going to claim that it's false that science has concluded the universe had a beginning. Go ahead, John.
Yeah. And Drew, to that, he says, actually, no. Physicists and philosophers do not all acknowledge that the universe had an absolute beginning. We can trace our universe's expansion backward in time to a point where our understanding of physics breaks down, but not to a point of absolute beginning. And then he goes on to say this. He says, models of cosmology where the universe did not have a beginning or where the beginning of the universe was not the beginning of the cosmos are seriously entertained. And then he says, theoretical physicists, many of whom are actually atheists, work on this constantly. Refusing to acknowledge this suggests that Kokel simply doesn't think scientific inquiry is even worth considering. Acting this way in a conversation with an atheist absolutely screams, I am unwilling to consider any idea not in line with my cherished beliefs.
Okay.
Interesting.
So the charge here is that I simply don't – well, there's two things going on. He denies – that there is a consensus about absolute beginning, okay?
Yeah.
Of course, my statement was about whether the universe was eternal, but that does imply absolute beginning, okay? If it's not eternal, it began, okay? excuse me. And then there's a challenge that that because I don't mention these other models of cosmology that are working on this, then I don't really care about scientific inquiry. First, a mea culpa here, because my fault on something. I did say in my piece that atheists can't explain where stuff came from. They don't even try. Well, that's not true. Okay, that was inaccurate. They don't even try part was inaccurate. And Drew properly corrects me on that. Okay, so my fault on that. But notice that I said there's hardly anybody in the world, any scientist or philosopher, who thinks the universe is eternal anymore. And this I'm going to stand behind, strictly speaking, although I think Alan Guth may be one of those astronomers who is an exception and believes in an eternal universe. But there's a caveat here. Though almost no one says the universe is actually eternal. This is still true. They don't say it's eternal. But they have not necessarily committed themselves to an absolute beginning. So they're on the fence on this one, all right? Basically, they basically say, we're still working on it. And so this is where Drew is kind of putting his wager on. They're still working on it, and Drew points that out. So notice the scientific claim that I did make, though. The scientific evidence for the beginning of the universe is really strong. Okay, I didn't give all that evidence. There wasn't time for it. Okay, so let me do it now. What is that evidence? There's at least three lines of evidence, actually kind of four if you include a philosophical argument. First, we have the evidence from observational astronomy. This is empirical evidence. The universe is expanding. Nobody contested that. And this was noted even by Einstein in the early 20th century. And it bothered him so much because of the implications of an expanding universe. If it's expanding, if you go back in time, you go back to a beginning. Oh, they don't like that. And so he created a thing called the cosmological constant that countered the effects of gravity in his equations to make it look like the universe appeared static. That was a steady state, all right, which is what everybody thought before that. Universe is eternal, steady state. All of a sudden, we got this expanding universe. Well, that didn't look good to Einstein, so he cheats.
Yeah.
All right, which he acknowledges he cheats later, because in the 1920s, you got Edwin Hubble looking through his telescope, and he notices the galactic redshift, the Doppler effect. That was confirmed by Georges Lemaître in 1927, and all of a sudden, all of this observational evidence shows the expanding universe that implies a beginning to the universe. And of course, Einstein repents, calling his fiddling with the physics the greatest blunder of his life. But I want you to notice something, John. Even Einstein was compelled to cheat because of the philosophic, metaphysical, if you will, implications of his empirical discovery, okay?
Yeah.
Then in 1964, Robert Dicke predicted that there would be a cosmic background electromagnetic radiation from the Big Bang. It was later discovered by Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson, and they won a Nobel Prize for that in physics in 1978. This is all empirical evidence, okay? The second law of thermodynamics, by the way, a lot of people don't talk about this anymore, but the universe is getting colder and colder and colder, all right? The energy is being dissipated into the universe. It can't be used again for productive work. Eventually, we're going to have a heat death where everything's going to be at absolute zero, and there's no way to avoid that. If the universe were eternal and didn't have an absolute beginning, we'd be at heat death now. All of these things are observational evidences, empirical data that had been talked about for over a century that the universe had an absolute beginning. Second, you have the equations of general relativity, and this we owe to Einstein, of course, and he talked about curvature of space-time, and as you go back in time, it gets tighter and tighter and tighter, and until you get to this singularity of infinite density, and that's the absolute beginning. All right. And these concepts were, of course, employed by Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose and George Ellis, as it turns out, with their singularity theorems, establishing an edge to space-time, which is an ultimate beginning. Now, Hawking is not comfortable with that. He's still working, was still working on it. He's not working on it anymore. He's gone.
Yeah.
But then there are philosophical problems with an eternal universe, the problem with actual infinities, or at least the problem with creating an actual infinity by successive addition. Simply put, you can't count to infinity, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But that's what it amounts to if the universe had an infinite age. Okay, this is all scientific, solid scientific evidence. By the way, I didn't even mention the equations of special relativity, and this is what Bohr, Guth, and Vilenkin have worked on, the famous BGV theorem that concluded that any universe, any kind of characterization of the universe at all, if the universe has been expanding throughout its history, cannot be infinite in time and must have had a beginning, okay?
Yeah.
Now, that is scientific evidence. And it is the reigning scientific evidence on this issue right now, John. And there's some philosophical evidence thrown in just for fun, all right? It's all on the table for an absolute beginning of the universe that we call the Big Bang. Now, I think that's enough evidence to show that my statement, the scientific evidence of the beginning of the universe is really strong, is a justified statement. All right. And by the way, the science is so strong, that notable scientists and philosophers, almost against their will, have conceded a supernatural cause to the universe. Take Caltech astronomer Alan Sandage. He's one of the world's most foremost observational cosmologists in the 20th century, who formerly described himself as a practicing atheist. I say formerly because he doesn't describe himself that way. In 1985, in Dallas, Texas, Standage gave a lecture describing the astronomical evidence for the beginning of the universe. Now, if the universe began, then, as my argument goes, what caused it? Something or nothing? And he presumes something did. And in his lecture, he shocked his listeners by calling it a supernatural creation. Three words there, the way he delivered it. And here's what he said. Wow. I'm quoting, "I now have to go from a stance as a complete materialistic rational scientist and say this supernatural event, to me, gives at least some credence to my belief that there is some design put in the universe." Close quote. In other words, astronomical evidence convinced Alan Sandage to move from being a practicing atheist to some kind of theist. And famously, Antony Flew,
yeah,
probably the most influential atheistic philosopher of the 20th century, in 2004, changed his mind, became a theist, wrote a book about it based on the scientific evidence. Astronomer Robert Jastrow, former director of NASA's Goddard Institute in Space Studies, same thing. And he's got a famous quote about how all the, you know, the scientists have been climbing the mount of ignorance, and when they get to the top, he pulls himself over the final rock. He's greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. Now, these are not nobodies.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that these notables are right because they're somebodies, because they're famous scientists or philosophers. What I'm saying is that people of this stature did not change their minds for no good scientific reason.
Yeah.
So my claim for the scientific evidence for the absolute beginning of the universe stands. Now, are there naysayers? Of course there are. There are theoretical models. There are proposals. There are conjectures. And there are speculations to the contrary. Of course there are. And especially those trying to exploit what might be called the quantum cosmology loophole. Lots of work being done here. I agree with Drew in this. Nothing wrong with that. But Drew's point needs to be qualified. There's a lot of work being done with theoretical models. But models and proposals and conjectures and speculations are not evidence until they are evidenced. And this is Drew's own criterion, because in his yeah, presentation, he says this, and I'll just read it for you, John. Quote, "None of these," and he's referring to an infinite variety of supernatural causes religions propose, all right? "None of these actually has explanatory power." That's my claim. Why not? "Until they can actually demonstrate their explanations to be true." Okay, good. Now, I actually think this requirement's a bit extreme, even from a scientific assessment perspective, but those are Drew's standards. Clearly, the speculative models that he's talking about are not the kind of empirical evidence that he champions.
Yeah.
The best we can tell from actual observation, not from theoretical conjecture. It's going on. okay, knock yourself out, no problem. But the best we can tell from actual observation, astronomical and mathematical evidence, is that the universe had a beginning. And so, I'm well within my scientific, observational, empirical, and philosophical rights. That's the actual evidence themselves, rather than models, speculations, to say that the universe had an absolute beginning. I could be wrong in that, but I'm not making this up. Now, let me jump to the next section. I'm looking at our clock, and boy, is it going by quickly. I'm glad we decided to use 2 hours. And chances are we're not going to get done with this in 2 hours. But
with no breaks.
Yeah, with no breaks. What I say in the next video segment then, and he includes it in his critique, is that if something is the thing that caused the universe rather than no thing, and that to me makes the most sense, then that something is going to have to be immaterial, that would be outside of the universe. It's the material universe that was the effect. It would have to be pretty smart. It would have to be pretty powerful. Okay,
yeah.
And personal, because only persons initiate causal chains, right? And that's getting pretty close to the G-O-D word, and that's what, of course, atheists want to avoid. So this is what he says in response to that claim, that point that I make on the video. John?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So then he responds, first, if asked what caused the universe to exist, a valid answer, which Kokel completely and suspiciously fails to mention, is, I don't know. It's not obvious that our intuitions about causation, which we've all gleaned from our experience inside the universe, can generalize to questions of causation regarding the universe itself, which is why I think systematic inquiry, like the scientific process, is better suited to reveal reliable information on the subject. Theoretical physicists, as I've said, have devised various models of cosmology based on our current understanding of physics, but we simply don't have enough to determine which, if any of them, accurately describes reality. For me, it would be dishonest to say anything other than, I don't know.
Okay, that's good. Thank you, John. And I think he should be honest with himself. No problem. He can say, I don't know. But the question is whether that is a legitimate response, all things considered. And there's a curious thing going on here, and this is the kind of appeal to empiricism that's made when empirical analysis is not possible. Notice what he says first. Quote, it's not obvious that our intuitions about causation, which we've all gleaned from our experience inside the universe, can generalize to questions of causation regarding the universe itself, to the cause of the universe. That would be outside the universe. And then he says, which is why I think systematic inquiry, like the scientific process, is better suited to reveal a reliable information about the subject. Do you see? I don't know if you see the problem there, John, but first of all, we don't have any reason to believe that the principle of causation breaks down outside of the universe. Okay? It's a metaphysical principle. It's not a physical principle.
Yeah, that's right.
All right? And David Hume made this really clear. You can't observe causation. You can just observe correlation of events, physical events. All right? But second here is, you cannot have a systematic inquiry like the scientific process, Drew's words, without assuming the causal principle. The scientific enterprise depends on it, all right?
That's good.
So if he says causation, we're not confident that causation works outside of the universe as a cause, as a way of thinking about how the universe came to be, then we can't use science. It's science is over with then. You've got to use some other tools. I'll talk about that in just a moment.
That's right. And well, he has a second objection. Do we want to?
Yeah,
get to
so
that?
Go ahead and read that, and then I'll respond some more.
Okay, so the second part of this objection is, he says, second, the conclusion that a powerful, intelligent, and personal being created the universe does not follow from the premises laid out here. This is a non sequitur. When some Christian apologists make this argument, they'll attempt to justify this conclusion with supporting arguments for why all these characteristics are necessary for the cause of the universe. I guess Kokel didn't see that as necessary for some reason, though.
But I actually did do that, John, and I just did it here as I role-played my own video thing. Because there is a cause, then the cause has to be outside of the material universe, therefore it's immaterial. Does he deny that a cause of the material universe has to be powerful? Who would deny such a thing? Does he deny that if it's going to initiate the cause, that it has to be personal? There is event causation, there's agent causation. This requires agency. All right. And I kind of make that appeal that this is a common sense type response. So, and once again, if you're going to talk about a cause prior to the universe, you're just going to have to abandon any pretense at doing science. And this is precisely where philosophy can help, because the notions that I'm appealing to, as I've just mentioned, are metaphysical. They're not physical. Either something caused the universe or nothing caused the universe. If something caused it, then that thing that caused it must be adequate to account for the effect. That was the nature of my argument. I just didn't throw that out there with no reasons, okay?
Well, he has more.
Okay, go ahead.
So there's a third part that he brings up. He says, third, what atheist is saying that they believe everything came from nothing? This is one of the most common misconceptions about atheists, and it's one which atheists have been correcting for as long as Christians have been spreading this misconception.
Okay, I want
he
to
goes
stop
on about
there. Just
yeah,
sure. Yeah, there's more here, but he's just getting bugged at me. We don't need to read that.
Okay.
So he says what atheist is saying that they believe everything came from nothing. Well, famously, Lawrence Krauss, for one, in his book titled "A Universe from Nothing." By the way, he's not in the backwaters. He's one of the main voices here. Okay. Secondly, I'm not saying atheists characteristically say this, that the universe came from nothing. What I'm saying is that's all they're left with, given the law, the logical categories that we have here. Now, there's an anecdote here I give about a dinner party that we don't have time to go into it. We just have a few more minutes in this hour. But then Drew questions whether the story is actually true or I just made it up. I didn't make it up. It actually happened. And of course, everybody here at the office knows, because the day after it happened, I talked about everybody with, and it's, and I'm not making the point in the anecdote that the universe must have been caused by God. This is another claim that he makes. I'm saying in the anecdote only that the universe must have had a cause. And even atheists, as the illustration demonstrates or the anecdote demonstrates, understand that all effects have causes. And there's a knocking on the door. Anyway, John, so we got to take a break there, and we'll pick this up in our next show and deal with the other bumps in the universe that Drew feels that I did not do an adequate job in defending. So good to talk about this stuff with you, John, and I'm glad to be able to address these things with regarding Drew. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason, and also John Noyes here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven, my friends. Bye-bye.